This interview with Professor Hubert Lam was carried out by Robert Ratcliffe at the University of East Anglia on the 25th of April 1985. Well, Hubert, I was told you were born in Bedford in 1913. Perhaps we should start this interview with you telling me a little bit about your forebears.
Well, Bedford didn't have much to do with it. I left there when I was only 4 months old, but the family certainly did. My grandfather was the well-known mathematician Horace Lamb, author of many books.
Lamb's Statics and Dynamics, I remember. I've used them very much in my youth.
And Lamb's Hydrodynamics, which still brings me in a small income. Or a mathematics book that was written more than 100 years ago. That's remarkable. And his children all became, or most of them became, rather prominent figures in quite a range of walks of life. And as the sole heir of a family with a range of professional knowledge and talents, I was very much overawed in my teens, so I felt very strongly that I would never measure up to this lot and what they expected of me. My father, the eldest son, was a professor of engineering in London University. His elder sister was a tutor in Newnham, in charge of one of the halls of Newnham College, Cambridge. A younger sister was a distinguished archaeologist with Greek experience, who married top civil servants, including at one stage my boss as supremo of the Air Ministry. And another uncle was chief, he was secretary of the Royal Academy of Arts in London for the whole of the first 50 years of my life. And another brother, uncle of mine, was a well-known artist who became a Royal Academician himself. So this was a very formidable inheritance.
I imagine a great deal was expected of you from your family right from the word go, is that so?
Absolutely, yes. And unfortunately, my father had far too precise ideas of exactly what I should do. He was determined I should become a mathematician and overdid the pressure to the point where I developed some resistance. I may have had an actual limitation. I won the school mathematics and science prize at Arundel.
Where were you at school?
I was at Arundel School. And I, in the sixth form, I won the School of Mathematics and Science Prize, but I think I had a distinct limitation in maths through some defect of memory, that I would get lost in very long, strung-out algebra, and eventually became a bit panicky about it.
Your family obviously did have a great influence with you. Was there anybody else who influenced you very much in your teens, apart from the immediate family or your grandparents and parents?
Yes, it so happened there were. Well, from childhood, Danish and Norwegian influences began through family, friends and connections. And of more interest to this particular interview, Lewis Richardson, L.F. Richardson, became known to me at the age of about 10. For several years I was in and out of his house because his son was a school friend of mine. And in my own family had brought me up to a very authoritarian religion of Anglo-Catholicism, which also aroused my resistance, and I was inevitably influenced very positively towards Quakerism just by what I fathomed of L.F. Richardson's mind.
But your meteorological enthusiasm didn't stem from L.F. Richardson?
No, that, I was too early in my life for that. It was only a few years later on that I became strongly interested in the weather and meteorology, from wondering what the weather would be for from holidays in the mountains, sort of thing. But I'd almost forgotten that, really, later on, after the teenage career of going through school and Cambridge. At Cambridge,
you were always going to go to university, I presume, with your family background and people pressurizing school career.
Nothing else would do.
Nothing else but Cambridge,
and indeed I luckily was accepted as an exhibitioner in my grandfather's own college, Trinity College, Cambridge, where he was at that stage an honorary fellow in his retirement.
But at this stage you really hadn't much idea where your education was leading you to.
No, I became more and more confused because mathematics was becoming distasteful, partly through my own limitation, but largely because I was being forced into it too much. And I did natural sciences, very interested in physics and chemistry. Mineralogy was the third. That proved to be an irrelevance, of course, later on. But I've been lucky in that quite a number of my other interests came up later in my career. After securing sufficient for my degree, science degree at Cambridge, by passing the first part of the natural sciences tripos, I put down my foot. I wasn't willing to specialize in any of the branches of science that I'd been doing, and changed over to geography with the encouragement of one of my aunts, and the Newnham aunt, and had my own plan had been to complete both parts of the geography tripos and make my career in that. I did the first part, which is a two-year course, in 1 year, but unfortunately my father didn't favour my going on to the fourth year necessary to do the second part, and so I ended with a mixed degree, and I was told it was a mediocre degree by my...
You didn't actually take part two geography?
I didn't take part two at all. I never spent the time there. And so I came away from Cambridge with this very mixed degree. I feel it was the low point of my career, really, although I was enthusiastic about geography and would have loved to go on to the second part of the geography.
Did any teachers at Cambridge have a great influence on you in geography or otherwise? J.H. Steers, for instance.
Yes, I knew Steers and still know him a bit. Yes, unfortunately not. I think my 1 year sojourn there was too brief. There was a young lecturer, Lewis, who was very influential but with me, but he died at an early stage, so that influence was lost.
So how did the transition occur from Cambridge to the... meteorology?
Well, it was a time of unemployment, and with that degree behind me, I spent really a whole year not knowing what I would do. I did a little work at London University in languages to prepare myself for the consular service, but my French wasn't good enough and didn't look likely to become good enough. And I applied for various things and didn't get them, and it was a matter of the greatest surprise when it turned out the meteorological office did accept me.
Who interviewed you?
I think the then director, Sir George Simpson, having been a pupil of my grandfather's, felt a sort of basic conviction that I must be capable of doing it. And I hope indeed that I didn't disappoint him. I had a fair amount of encouragement from Lempfert and Absalom, and the directors in those days of the Met Office.
I mean, this was quite a milestone, wasn't it? I think you probably were quite happy when you having had a rather indeterminate period.
Yes.
And then finally getting into a subject which
I was keenly interested in. It was a tremendous stroke of luck, and I did appreciate it tremendously, and I felt a great need to make up for lost time. It so happened that at that stage my training, the sort of lab work of the training course, which was at Croydon Airport under Peters, the lab work was preparatory dog's body work, measuring up the wind gradient, pressure gradients for winds on the Atlantic for the transatlantic flying, transatlantic air route that was being prepared. And this
was before there were any regular transatlantic.
Yes, it was. They began in July 1939, and just before the war. And
when you joined the Met Office, had you any sort of clear idea of the sort of work you wanted to do? I mean, were you interested in forecasting or climatology or research of some sort or another?
Just that I was interested in the whole subject. I'd been interested in cloud formations, cloud development, from my love of hill walking very young teens, and I was enthusiastic about coming back into this subject for real, and the opportunities. But I did want to equip myself as a better meteorologist than I looked like being, with just the 6 month training course on top of the type of degree I had actually secured. And so as Ireland came into our discussions because of that was the to be the in those days
for the transatlantic
the aircraft of those days could only fly the shortest crossing from Ireland to Newfoundland, and the Irish Met Service was just beginning and announced a 2-year training course, including a whole year at MIT. I raised my eyebrows
in America.
Yeah. Massachusetts Institute of Technology. I was very interested in that announcement and wondered whether it would be wise for me to think of changing to the Irish Meteorological Service to secure that training.
But you did quite a few things before this, didn't you? After your initial training at Croydon,
I wrote
one or two papers, which I remember quite well as I started in meteorology about this time.
I wrote a rather bad paper, I think, on Greenland, because I was very fascinated with Greenland. I wanted to see Greenland.
About wind erosion in Scotland, I remember, as well as on Scottish
Isles. Yeah, that's right. Well, in fact, of course, I was posted at the end of my course to a Scottish station, east coast of Scotland, Montrose, and had the luck to go to live with a family that was very congenial. I had a real home from home there, in some ways smoother life than my own disciplinarian home. And I became very devoted to things Scottish and to the meteorology that I was there doing. The problem of the Haas, or the sudden onset type of North Sea fogs, yes, that come in over the coast there, and the wind-blown trees, as you say, and other such things. And
so you wrote 3 or 4 papers, actually, before the war, which was probably rather remarkable for a young meteorologist who had only just joined the office.
Yes, I wrote one about Iceland too. Yes, I suppose.
Yes, you visited Iceland.
Yes, I sailed all around Iceland on a summer holiday. Well, it's actually autumn by the time I did it, but it was my summer holiday for 1938. It was actually during the Munich crisis, as it turned out, and I was summoned to return to duty. But as I was on a ship off the east coast of Iceland, there was no way of doing it. The whole crisis was over by the time I got back.
So that really leads us perhaps into the war, and you were talking about your interest in transatlantic flights.
Yes.
This is really where you spent most of the war.
Well, it came about quite by accident that Ireland was to be my fate for some time. I mentioned my thoughts were moving towards the Quaker interpretation of Christianity as a result, in the first place, of my contact with Richardson. Inevitably that led to misgivings about the Met Office and its close involvement with the RAF, it wasn't long really before a crisis came up in June or early July 1939, when I was asked to go on temporary duty to forecast for gas spraying, and that was something that I felt I hadn't taken up meteorology to do.
Well, no, that would cause anybody some twinges of conscience.
Well, I was quite clear that I couldn't do that. That wasn't the object of my science. And I simply said no. Whereupon the stand-in director, the N.K. Johnson, was away abroad at that time. The stand-in director, Corliss, demanded my resignation, which I promptly gave. This was all by return message on the teleprinter. And a little over a week later...
You did actually resign.
I did actually resign.
On the spot.
Yeah. A week later, Johnson returned, and a message came over the printer asking me to reconsider my decision. Would I be willing to be transferred to the Irish Meteorological Service to be involved in the transatlantic flying? And of course I would. I regarded that as a very civilized...
You say that was just really what you would prefer to do at that juncture.
Very civilized solution it was.
Yeah.
Yes, indeed. I respected N.K. Johnson tremendously for that. I went there. I found myself there through pretty well the whole of the war, as it turned out. I found myself in charge of the British and Allied secret codes there, but that didn't worry me, and I had no problems over it.
And you did develop some methods of forecasting winds across the Atlantic.
I developed some methods
of stab at it.
Yes, I had a stab at forecasting, and
I remember there was a paper on that, was there not?
Forecasting the winds at 10,000 feet over the North Atlantic. This was quite a special experience, but before I actually had such direct responsibility for the forecasting for the transatlantic route as I later had, I had the shock of being told that with the collapse of the Irish Met Service's training program, owing to the war, I would have to be the professor. I would have to teach the course, the 2-year course, which is much longer training than I'd had myself, and it was the most tremendous shock to me. I think my long history of insomnia began from that point. Incidentally, I replied to Nagel, who was then director in Ireland, that I didn't really know enough to do it. How on earth would I do it? So he said, oh, that'll be all right, because there's a very fine book just published of Tor Bergeron's lectures, the Swedish meteorologist. He was too lazy to write it himself, his lectures in Scandinavia and in Russia, but a Czech had written them into a fine book, but the only thing was the book was in German. so I had to set to and learn German and understand the meteorology in time for each day's lecture and keep ahead of the course.
Did you actually not know much German at that
Mighty time? Little. I had had 2 terms of 1 lesson a week
at school of
scientific German, just 2 terms, 1 lesson a week of so-called scientific German. It was actually German fairy tales.
I'm not surprised you developed insomnia at this stage.
It was quite arduous. Anyhow, it seemed to work, and I still have friendly relations with my pupils who rose to eminence as director of the Irish Met Service and so on.
Well, that was obviously a very interesting stage in your career.
Very.
And it lasted quite a while, really.
It lasted till late in 1944, actually, very near the end of the war. The problem of forecasting was a nut to crack, too, because for the transatlantic, because being a neutral country, we didn't have access to any of the secret weather reports from the ocean. We had no reports whatever from the ocean.
This is probably where you started developing your intuition for... drawing charts on a large scale
with fragmentary data,
the general circulation.
Yes, it was so. Yes, indeed. I had read a paper or two by Namias before the war, actually, but I was fascinated by that, and this gave me the experience of drawing charts of very nearly the whole northern hemisphere on as a daily working map, which at a very early stage, not many people were drawing charts of anything like that coverage or anything like that view of the overall large-scale circulation.
There were some horrible gaps, though.
There were some horrible gaps, yes.
The intuition and the knowledge of meteorology comes in.
Right, and of course we had to make the absolute most. We had to systematise the information that the aircraft themselves brought in.
Yes.
So it was an exercise in drawing, getting the large-scale features of the circulation right.
And
being very realistic about how much or how little you knew about the detail. And the briefing of those pilots before they went out into the unknown was a very serious responsibility. And I'm very happy to say we had an absolutely clean safety record throughout the war.
Yes, I can really sympathise with your problem there, because I, in fact, was at Stranraer 2 years during the war when we were sending flying boats halfway out escorting convoys, so we had similar type of war.
Yes, yes, it must have been very similar.
However, this stage in your life obviously, in fact, prepared you perhaps for the next, when you went on this expedition of the Balena, a whaling
That's
expedition.
That's right.
To the Antarctic, of all places.
I came back to the British Met Office, and not very long after the war, I volunteered for the post of meteorologist on the whaling factory ship Balena that was being sent out to catch whales in the Antarctic Ocean. They thought the whales would be much scarcer than they in fact turned out to be, so they were taking aircraft, amphibious aircraft, little walrus aircraft, for whale spotting, and the flight commander said he wouldn't do it without meteorological advice. So I went down there, and it turned out, of course, that the only way you could know anything at all about what was going on with the weather systems and what to expect was to attempt to map the large-scale features of the southern hemisphere.
Yes, I think this is about the first time that synoptic charts of the southern polar regions were really drawn. Attempts were made to draw.
Well, of course, there was pretty much of a gap towards the pole itself, but the hemisphere.
Quite a few stations around there.
Yes, and the hemisphere was well covered in the subtropical latitudes where the anticyclones were, and you could get the shape of things.
Yes.
And this was
had the intuition. Your early training perhaps at points.
Well, this was the basis of the technique. I mean, just as you had to be very realistic about how much and how little you knew in briefing the aircraft for the Atlantic crossing, so one had to be absolutely realistic here too. And you could get the shape of the general flow of the atmosphere, and you could be fairly sure about which was the direction of maximum danger, where the next disturbance was liable to come from. And the technique was to send the aircraft out in the worst, an aircraft out in the worst possible direction first, to report, report on how far there were clear conditions, you see. And on this basis, it worked. And again, we had an absolutely clean, incident-free record. But an important development from that was that when the season was over, I got the opportunity to collaborate with a Dutch meteorologist who'd been in a similar position on a Dutch whaling ship. I went over to the Netherlands to do it. And also I had contact with the Naval Weather Service bloke in Simonstown, near Cape Town, who was concerned with the whaling grounds in the Antarctic. And really constructed later maps with full data, and from all the whaling ships, all the whaling fleets, which were,
this led you to some of your papers, no?
They were kept secret while one was down there, with commercial rivalry.
Yes.
But by comparing the working maps with the later ones on fuller data, one could establish the error margins. And this business of drawing maps from fragmentary data and subsequently testing them has, of course, been the basis of a lot of my later work. And was an ideal preparation, really, for making for reconstructing the historical
yes.
past.
And of course, it led to a lot of very interesting papers about the Antarctic.
Yes, it did a bit. That's yes. right. Yes.
It must have been shortly after that you got married, was it, Hubert?
Yes, within a year of coming back from the Antarctic. That's right.
Where did you first meet your wife then?
That summer on getting back in the Highlands in Speyside, which we still love. I was there in the hills again. She was too.
loves the hills too.
Oh, that's right. Yes, yes. We're very fond of Speyside, and we had common interests in the Norwegian mountains as well. And that's been
Knowing your wife
pleasure.
Fairly well, she must have given you a lot of support during your career.
Yes, she's been a constant moral support to me, and we've had a very happy home.
So after the Antarctic expedition, what really happened then? It's then, I think, that I read your paper on types and spells of weather around the British Isles, or some such title, which was published about 1950. Was this the time when you started in climatology, really?
No, it was a little bit before, really. Soon after coming back from the Antarctic, I was posted to the newly formed Forecasting Research Division at Dunstable, and interested in medium to longer range forecasting, which I had been privately interested in for quite some time before. Even in my time in Ireland, I was thinking about the life cycle of anticyclones and what they could tell us about rather longer periods of weather. And so interest in naturally defined seasons, defined by the weather itself, was an obvious line for me to follow. And that resulted in the paper on types and spells and natural seasons, which was published in the Quarterly Journal, and to some other papers subsequently about British weather around the year and so forth. But that was all interrupted.
Did you start the daily classification then, or was that later?
I received.
That's another thing. Which
yes.
One of your major.
Right.
Things, I think.
I received a ready-made classification from somebody called Levick, which
he
was still around, which was the germ of the idea, but I was very dissatisfied with his classification after a while. and developed my own slightly, well, really not so basically, but slightly amended definitions, and more comprehensive, I think. And I proceeded to classify a much longer run of years, daily weather maps. I did them in a random order, not chronologically, so that biases of trends would not
wouldn't
creep in, so on. And I ended up with a classification of every day's weather maps, thanks to the magnificent archives of the Met Office, now at Bracknell.
Because that actually wasn't published till much later.
No, 1972.
I was just trying to get at where you started thinking.
Yes, well, that classification is continuous from 1861 to the present date. It's still being kept going. And also 6 years in the 1780s.
Yes. Well, after that initial spell at Harrow,
Overseas service. Germany and Malta, both of them very good experience, but not very relevant to what followed, really, except insofar as I learned some more about the general circulation and lower latitudes.
I got the impression through reading your papers after you'd been to Malta that you sort of began to look at how the northern and the southern hemisphere circulations joined up and
how
they were different, and started thinking about what was driving them.
Now, that was a fascinating point too about the Balena voyage to the Antarctic whaling grounds, crossing the equator, crossing the intertropical front zone, and so on. I was fascinated by that. By a lucky stroke, we sailed south with various halts. We sailed south from the British Isles, well, from Norway, to...
Was the front in the ocean known in those days, you know? Yes, they were.
We travelled with an atmospheric front, a cold front, all the way from the British Isles latitude down to till it merged into the intertropical front by a lucky chance. That taught me that it does do that. Then later on sailed through the Southern Ocean and across the convergences, which are equally strong fronts in the Southern Ocean, in the water itself. And I learnt to be a bit sceptical about the notions that were then existing, that these Antarctic convergence, well, I've forgotten the names of them now, the subtropical convergence and the Antarctic convergence, had very fixed positions, because they were really quite different, both on the voyage south and on the voyage north. I think one takes all those things with a grain of salt when you've had some more observations.
One of the things that comes out of all your work, I mean, when you first started in climatology, it was a very moribund subject, and climate was something which was fixed.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Very soon you realised it wasn't fixed, and it was
continually
varying.
That's right. I had a very lucky break when I came back from my overseas service, and the Met Office got into a terrible muddle over my posting.
This was in 54.
In 54, yes. They posted me to Harrow, to the office that was then in Harrow. The intention was that I should be in charge of the library and editor of the Meteorological Magazine, as George Bull, who had been those things up to then, was promoted. But George promptly got a nervous breakdown, faced with the new responsibilities he had,
and it
shortly turned out that the only thing that would cure him was to go back to his old job. So they didn't know what to do with me. And I was put supernumerary to the climatology division and forgotten about, essentially, for a couple of years, which was a...
I don't think that was ideal from your point of view. I mean, some
ideal.
People might have slacked and done nothing, like you, obviously, had a freelance go ahead and you could do your own thing.
Yes, I discovered the Met Office archives in the sub-basement, two floors below the ground, with no telephone, which was splendid, because I could work uninterrupted. And I started with the idea, really, I was interested in climatic change, and the subject was in an awful muddle, as you said, and very much, very tremendously neglected up to that point in the development of climate. And
there wasn't really anybody much to help you in these days,
was there? Well, Brooks...
Sidney Brooks, of course, was a typical climatologist.
Yes.
He wasn't very dynamically inclined.
No, he wasn't. I came back to when I found myself.
About, you were telling me about this man Godwin in Cambridge.
Oh, that's a wee bit later. I mean, first of all, I had the idea that finding myself in the climatology division, I better have some training, and a grounding in statistics and so on. But somehow the Met Office didn't seem to be interested in that idea, and it never came off. So in the end, when I was at some point appointed in charge of a branch, I spent an evening writing down on the back of an envelope my ideas about climatology, which were all very much a forecaster's ideas of climatology. How does climate develop? And synoptic climatology, really, as I later discovered, very much as Bergeron had outlined it in 1930.
As we managed to get going in the Met Office 10 years later or more.
Yes. Well, my first thought, of course, was to use these archives, magnificent archives, really, in the sub-basement to conjure up at least monthly mean barometric pressure and wind circulation maps for the individual Januarys and Julys, really. It was all that was manageable, of a latter part of the last century, to compare them with this century and see if there were differences apparent. I've happily discovered that one could go right back to 1750. The barometer had very early on been developed into really a good instrument, and I produced maps back to 1750, and again a system of testing them and testing their analysis. Learning from my earlier experience in the Southern Hemisphere.
I think you did a lot, really, towards developing techniques of analysis.
Yes.
We've talked about the Northern Hemisphere and the Southern Hemisphere in relation to flying the Atlantic and the whaling, but this was another use of the same sort of thing.
Yes, it was something I was very fascinated with and keen on, and I sometimes wondered whether this was where the artistic heritage of my family came in a wee bit. That I was definitely happy with maps and mapping techniques, rather than with long strings of algebra. Anyway, is it not flashing? Yes.
We were talking about Harrow, Hubert, and the fact you didn't get a lot of support really from the Met Office as a whole. Was there anybody else outside the office who really had much influence on your career at this
well,
stage and your thought and what you wanted to do?
Yes, certainly the slight contacts I'd had with Bergeron and Rossby already, even back in my Dunstable Forecasting Research Division days, had set me thinking, and I'd struck up a sort of pen friend, a correspondence friendship with Flohn. Over already 10 years by that time. Our interests were very similar, I think. And Scherhag, too, in Germany, who encouraged me. But really, at that point, and so far as new development of my career was concerned, the most important contact came from, like a bolt from the blue, really, from Harry Godwin, who was professor of botany in Cambridge, and had for some time been leading a series of studies and regular discussion meetings which covered the whole range of quaternary science.
He was primarily interested, I suppose, in pollen.
He was, yes, as far as this country is concerned, he was really one of the great pioneers of pollen analysis of the deposits going back right over post-glacial and into Ice Age time. His associates later went much farther back than that. And he'd already gathered quite an interdisciplinary group around himself with the Cambridge Radiocarbon Dating Laboratory under his authority. And he wrote to me in 1959 saying that he was delighted to hear that the Met Office had at last got somebody working on climatic change, that he had been trying for many, many years to stimulate some interest in that, and it was a great thing. They were very interested to establish contact, and would I care to go over to Cambridge and take part in their quaternary discussions, which I did, and it was the most tremendous education to me. I made contacts with the widest range of work in quaternary science, and of course the dating techniques as well, things which I probably would never have become acquainted with.
Yes, it sort of extended your timescale backwards.
Oh, it did. Yes, I was forced into going backwards, farther than I had intended originally. It was a new techniques were needed. You weren't using meteorological data in the ordinary sense to go back, but they wanted answers about things like the warmest, the nature of the climate.
Yes, I can see
climate
that was just the sort of thing that would stimulate your interest straight away.
Yes, warmest post-glacial times and late ice age times and so forth.
Well, I always think, you know, looking back through some of your work, that one of the milestones was when you started thinking about volcanic activity and what effect that had on climate.
Yes.
How did that evolve? Can you say anything about that?
Well, having produced my series of atmospheric pressure and wind maps back to 1750 and got involved with the nature of climate in the latter end of the last ice age and the warmest post-glacial times, following my contact with the Cambridge botanists, I was pretty much worried by the fact that people could be asking me about this man who goes on and on and on reconstructing different climates. Has he no ideas about what causes the differences in climate? So, in fact, I had quite a list of ideas, which included variations in the transparency of the atmosphere, most obviously through volcanic activity, but also possible variations in the sun. And
I expect you'd notice that, you know, the weather went off a bit after Krakatoa
and
in the early part of the century.
That's right.
This sort of thing.
Well, it struck me that probably the easiest one of these, and of course the variations of the ocean circulation were also on the list, because there's a lag factor involved there that could be of importance. But it seemed to me that probably the easiest one to have a look at first was volcanic activity, and it was necessary really to construct.
How did you get your volcanological series in? I mean, how did you find out the dates of all the major volcanic eruptions back?
Well, I rummaged around a good deal and found that there were volcanologists, a very notable one in Germany in 1917 and 1927 had published
chronologies.
Mm. But of course the estimation of the magnitude of the eruptions wasn't really very satisfactory from the meteorological point of view, that other things clouded the issue. Well, what we needed to know was the amount of stuff in the atmosphere and how it spread. And of course the ideas that had come out of following the trace elements resulting from the nuclear bomb tests in the 1950s had told us quite a lot about the high-level circulation that wasn't known before.
Yes, we knew quite a bit about the high-level circulation, but how did you find out anything about the size of the particles?
I had to read it up, and I had to see what was known, and I made this most tremendous pile of notes about the 3 or 4 inches thick it became, of factual data, really, more particularly the details about individual eruptions, as many as were known. I had to apply my own reassessment to the list that had been produced by that German volcanologist, Karl Sapper. Sapper, really, S-A-P-P-E-R. This resulted in a sort of chronology, which I went over many times to see if I got the same answer repeatedly, till I was satisfied that I was getting something like a sensible scale of magnitudes. I took the then best known eruption, that of Krakatoa in 1883, as my baseline. I gave that a scale reading of 1,000, and I went up and down from there, developed means a routine of allocating numbers. It turned out that there was one eruption at the beginning of the 19th century in 1815, Tamboro in the East Indies, that pretty certainly exceeded the Krakatoa eruption, and was followed by a very famous year, 1816, the year without a summer. And there were things like that. But when I'd got all this material together and on my windowsill, I really funked ignoring my other work in order to get on with this for quite some time. Then in the end, I thought it must be done, and I wrote it into a paper, which, before I showed it to the Met Office, I thought needed some vetting by a geologist or volcanologist, because inevitably there was a good deal of that in it, and I didn't know any geologist or volcanologist, apart from one in Iceland. I wrote to him, but I thought it better be a British volcanologist, so I looked up the Royal Society yearbook and thereby got the name of Professor Wager in Oxford, who was then chairman or secretary, I forget which, of the British Volcanological Research Committee. And I wrote him a little note to ask if he could possibly arrange for this to be looked over for me.
Advise me
on whether, well, it was a big thing. I felt it was asking a lot to spend time on this document. But he was very kind and said, yes, send it along to Oxford. I think he may have invited me to take it to Oxford, I've forgotten. And I left it with him, and he had a Royal Society research student there who was working in the same field, and between them they looked over this paper, and only about a month or 6 weeks later they contacted me and asked me to come over to Oxford. So I went over expecting to be taught my lessons in volcanology and what I would have to do to correct it. Instead, he said, this is splendid. It ought to be published by the Royal Society.
Well, that's an honour indeed.
So that was, it was also a bit...
A good tribute to all your hard work in getting the data together, and it happened in such a good fashion.
I was very bucked, of course, but it also was a tricky question how to put this suggestion to the Meteorological Office and its hierarchy.
Yes. And please, can I publish this in the Royal Society?
Well, to cut a long story short, it took them a week or two to decide the answer was no. And back the whole lot went onto my windowsill, where it stayed for literally 3 or 4 years. Then fate took a hand. There was a volcanic eruption, a very small one, on British territory.
In the Antarctic,
Deception Island. And this caused the British Volcanological Research Committee to meet. And the chairman sitting there said, oh, I forgot to say that my backer, Professor Wager, unfortunately had died 3 weeks after my interview, so that I had lost that backing, except that his research student knew all about it and was now a member of the Volcanological Research Committee. So when the then chairman of the committee meeting after the eruption on Deception Island said, have we no work going on and we'd like to be able to show that Britain is doing some work in this field, my paper got mentioned, and the chairman wanted to know why the dickens it hadn't been published. And I was then commanded to publish it to the Royal Society. And the Met Office managed to withdraw its objections and decide it was quite a good paper after all. So that one got published, and I did actually, jointly with you, write a paper on sea temperatures as well.
Yes, that's the other thing, I think, which you began to think of as influencing climate at this stage in your career. I mean,
yes, I had wanted to take it into account. I had developed
Of course, the data was in a pretty shaky state. And
yes.
All the time I was in Meta 13, we were desperately trying to get a homogeneous and comparable set of sea surface temperatures covering as much of the world's ocean as possible. I think they've done it now, but in those days we didn't really know all that much.
No, back in my time in Harrow and my exploration of the sub-basement there, I had been very impressed with the really marvellous archives the British Met Office has, you know.
Especially these ships' logs.
And as early as 1958 or 9, I had started trying to put the suggestion that this really ought to be worked up into a good data set of sea temperatures for covering all the oceans it was, going right back into the 1850s.
I think you did manage to achieve something with your analysis techniques and intuition and knowing about the general circulation. And other things, we were able to try out some ideas.
We were, yes.
Cold oceans and warm oceans and they affected the genocide.
And of course that has continued to be an interest of mine. I mean, one of the papers that I found most interest in writing, really late stage of my career, was the attempt to reconstruct the pattern of the ocean surface currents in the neighborhood of the Northeast Atlantic and the sea surface temperature patterns back into the Little Ice Age period of 300 years ago. I published a paper there in Quaternary Research in 1979 on the Little Ice Age pattern of the sea temperature, late 1600s, that reconstructed partly from an extension, really, of the series of sea temperatures, which is a very long series from the Faroe Islands, which midway between Scotland and Iceland, which is near the mean position of the water current boundary at times, between the warm North Atlantic drift and the polar water. And I had discovered with my colleagues in the climatic research unit in this later environment in East Anglia, we had discovered that the quite long-term averages of sea surface temperature in the Faroe Islands actually vary more over the last 100 years of record, had varied more than the prevailing air temperatures over the continent and in England. So the ocean was not such a stable environment, after all, in the neighbourhood of the water current boundary.
Yes, it's really something to know. really, we're coming up to another milestone in your career, really, when you decided to leave the Met Office. But perhaps before we talk about that, would you like to, do you think there's anybody in the Met Office or otherwise who's affected your career up to this stage? You mentioned Rosby and one or two others. One feels that your climatological work in the Met Office was very largely your own thing, but there must have been some support, I think.
Well, C.E.P. Brooks had a bit of influence there. I think, really, it was more in the nature of encouragement of Sutton, Graham Sutton, who seemed to me, at least, to be primarily responsible for my special merit promotion, which was...
We didn't mention that. When was that?
1963.
That was really quite an honour, and that enabled you to carry on working without too many administrative...
That's right. That gave me, really, climatic
and
research...
A sort of formal recognition of your special merit.
That gave me climatic research as my field, yes.
Yes.
It was a great thing, but as time showed, the subject, this was partly, I think, because of a change in the climate itself, that the earlier 20th century warming really faltered, didn't continue after the 50s.
The
60s were quite a shake-up, and the subject became of great practical interest. For a while I was in charge of the climatological inquiries branch of the Met Office.
Really, we're coming up to another milestone in your career, really, when you decided to leave the Met Office. But perhaps before we talk about that, would you like to, do you think there's anybody in the Met Office or otherwise who's affected your career up to this stage? You mentioned Rosby and one or two others. One feels that your climatological work in the Met Office was very largely your own thing, but there must have been some support, I think.
Well, C.E.P. Brooks had a bit of influence there. I think, really, it was more in the nature of encouragement, the encouragement of Sutton, Graham Sutton, who seemed to me, at least, to be primarily responsible for my special merit promotion, which was...
We didn't mention that. When was that?
1963.
That was really quite an honour, and that enabled you to carry on working without too many administrative.
That's right. That gave me really climatic
and
research.
A sort of formal recognition of your special merit.
That gave me climatic research as my field. Yes.
Yes.
And it was a great thing, but as time showed. The subject, this was partly, I think, because of a change in the climate itself, that the earlier 20th century warming really faltered.
It didn't
continue after the 50s.
The 60s
were quite a shake-up, and the subject became of great practical interest. For a while I was in charge of the Climatological Inquiries branch of the Met Office, and that was before my special merit promotion, but the subject became of interest. I got asked to speak on the radio about it and so forth. And by only two or three years after my special merit promotion, my work really had come to a standstill because there was no time to do anything but answer letters.
Yes.
And that was a serious point. The subsequent Director General, after Sutton's retirement, was not, I think it's fair to say, so interested in at least in my approach to this work, and I was bound to be interested myself when Gordon Manley, who had long been a friend of mine, who was about to retire from his professorship of environmental sciences at Lancaster, wanted me to be his successor and tried very hard to persuade me to go there. I went and had a look at the place, but...
You didn't like Lancaster, perhaps.
I'm not much of a one for the west side oceanic climates myself, and Lancaster was too much a scene of the northern industrial decay at time, and I felt it was rather a sad place, really. That the new university, which ought to be helping, was insulated from the town by some fields, and people were not living in Lancaster very much. I couldn't see myself transferring my family, who were then in their teens, from the zestful atmosphere of Guildford in the southeast to Lancaster. And very much to Manley's sorrow, I think, it was a rather hard pill for him to swallow, I turned it down. I didn't apply.
You have hankerings after going to a university.
Yes,
about this time.
Yes, that really started my mind thinking in that direction. And Sutton.
And this was a time too when you must have been. Had you started on the first part of your major work?
I had. Yes. 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 As a result of my BBC talks, Methuen had contacted me.
You had already published a book on the changing climate.
I had, yes.
A collection of papers.
I owe a good deal to Methuen's, really, for their encouragement and support. They wanted me to write a book right back in 1961. I told them I didn't know enough. Then Sutton got me to do a rewrite of one of C.E.P. Brooks's books, which delayed things. And then I started thinking about the book that Methuen wanted and was so rash as to work on it a little bit for 3 years without a contract. It wasn't making a lot of progress, actually, because there was a lot of work involved. But they were awfully nice to me. They used to have me to lunch once a year to show that I was, and did me well, show that they were still interested as well as I was. And in the end, of course, I did it. But it was all getting very, very difficult with the growing interest in the subject and no time to make fresh ground.
That was the changing climate you were talking about, the first Methuen book, wasn't it?
No, that was a stopgap. Methuen asked me to write a book. Maybe the book they had in mind was most like the one on climate and history that I finally published in 1982. But 21 years earlier, they asked me to write a book, and what emerged in the end was the two-volume book on climate, present, past, and future. And they became a bit worried about the fact that I wasn't getting... I told them I didn't know enough and that it was bound to take time. But nice as they were, they began to get a little bit uneasy, I think, about how long it was all taking. So I told them that if they wanted a book quickly, the best thing would be to collect together some of my published papers.
Yes.
And that was how the changing climate came about.
Yeah. And then, of course, the work on your two major volumes took something like 15 years.
That was a tremendously long slog.
I don't know how you managed that when you were doing all your other work as well. I mean, how did you
edit
out the data? And I mean, there's an enormous amount of data,
oh, yes,
tables and dependencies.
Well, I'd been collecting it, and
you must have been burning the midnight oil.
I was,
to
yeah.
Large extent in those days.
Yes, I was, and. I owe a good deal of gratitude to my family for standing it, really. But about the time when things were obviously getting rather difficult, 1960, after turning down Lancaster, I was still in touch with Sutton, who thought I ought to.
Yes, of course, the Met Office has a pretty strict retirement age, don't they?
Yes, quite.
Very young and active for your age. I think one of the things you were thinking was that you didn't really want to retire.
That's right.
And that you would jolly well have to go when you were 60.
That's right. Very true.
You really thought you had a lot more in you yet.
And I wanted a few younger scientists around me to join in and look after some.
I'm feeling myself. I'm far too early to retire.
Yes. Well, I did need younger scientists around me to help with the data too.
And to come up with outrageous ideas.
That's right.
Might not be so outrageous after all.
That's right. Very, very true.
So around about when was it? The very early 70s, I suppose.
Well, my first contact with the chap who became first dean of the School of Environmental Sciences at East Anglia was about 1968, and it became clear that there was likely to be some sort of room within his thinking of planning for something of this sort, if the money could somehow be counted up. And through Sutton's influence, I got an initial grant from Shell.
Yes, I think you did a lot of spade work trying to get this department off the ground.
Oh, I did. I did indeed, yes. Between
me... Only Shell, was it?
No, well,
Some meteorological services gave you some support.
Well, they did. Well, only once it had got started, once we'd actually taken the plunge and it existed. Mm. It was essential to take the plunge. But Professor Clayton here at East Anglia introduced Nuffield, the Nuffield Foundation, to the business too. And between the Shell and the Nuffield grants, we were able to get started. But when I came here in 1972, I was pretty well appalled that the funds were not sufficient to give anybody else a guaranteed salary, only a three-year contract, besides myself. And after two or three years, things were looking pretty precarious, faced really with breakdown. But I must say, we had a great deal of help from the beginning from other Met services, the Danish Meteorological Service, the Irish Meteorological Service, I think, and Sweden, Norway, and Iceland also deserve mention as having helped a great deal with data. Very handsome gifts from the United States sources as well, including the United States Air Force in East Anglia, data.
But all this was after you'd done
plunge. We had to exist first.
That's right,
yes. That's right. And I must say that in the end, it's funny, the things that helped, I wasn't experienced enough to foresee how any of these things would go, but after only about two and a bit years, when it looked as if the finances were really getting very shaky indeed and faced with the end, some mention in an article in Nature, as I later learnt, got passed around the government offices in Washington. Which stimulated the Rockefeller Foundation.
Yes, of course, that solved the problems.
That solved the problems quite a bit. And soon the Wolfson Foundation also came forward with a handsome gift. And really we've gone on from one thing to another, always a little bit anxious, at least during my term as director. I think things have got a bit easier by now, but I got so sick of the money chase that I did decide I really must retire on my 65th birthday, and I have never discussed the finances of the climatic research since.
Of course, another aspect we haven't really talked much about is your work on the relation between historical events and climate. I think you've always been rather interested in things like why was wine grown in the 12th century or thereabouts?
Yes.
And, why did what happened to the Armada? What sort of stimulated your interest in that?
I think that goes right back to family, really, family origins. It was a sort of a common interest, although my grandfather was known as a mathematician. He and I think all his progeny have had a strong interest in human history, most particularly in what you might call natural history, what merges into what's ordinarily understood as natural history. In fact, I have become made a member of the Danish Natural History Society as a result of my work. But the sort of human history that is really how the people live, rather than the battles and the... It's quite true, I've had some interest in the Spanish Armada. That was a data question. The Spanish Armada didn't altogether sail in vain because they had some they kept ships' logs. And
so
we can analyse the weather now afterwards better than they could at the time.
But you're obviously interested in that sort of thing.
Yes.
You read something about the climate in Saxon times, I think, not so long
ago.
Yes,
that's right. Well, any period, I suppose, has its interests, and if often these things have been written in response to some demand, somebody wanted to know, and I've had to scratch around the data and see what it's possible to say. And
still, you had quite a hand in the. Well, did you do it all more or less yourself? This conference on climate and history, which you had at the university.
Well, it was my idea. In the end, it took place some months after I'd retired, and I had a.
But I felt that the book that came out of that at the end was very much your field, really.
Yes, it was a matter of great interest to me. I was struggling really from 1960 onwards to get historians interested. This is another thing that I think.
Yes, they tend to work in their own watertight compartment.
Yes, they're rather shy off science and scientific fields. I think it's sort of sad to say archaeologists are more liable to be interested than historians seem to be. But
it's a general fault of a lot of scientists in a way, isn't it, that they tend to work in their own discipline and
it
not
is, yes.
much about
That's right.
closely related ones, or even realise sometimes that other things may come into it apart from their own science.
Yes, that is a grave danger, and it's not limited to scientific fields of learning either. I think people feel most at home doing their own thing, and it is necessary to look over your shoulder sometimes and see what else influences it.
Have you ever served on any scientific committees? And I mean, mostly your work has been sort of original climatological work of one sort or another, but you've been asked quite a lot to help on various committees.
I was on the British National Antarctic Research Committee for 20 years. Came off that when I retired.
Did that involve actually much work, or did you have much influence?
I don't know how much. I don't know how much influence. I attended all the meetings and took part in the discussion. It was a Royal Society committee, and I think it had a good deal of influence
on the funding
of the British Antarctic Survey and whatever it was called in the earlier times. Correspondingly, I also was, for a time, I was chairman of the WMO, World Meteorological Organization Working Group on Climatic Variation, and was responsible for one of their reports. Yes, and also on their polar meteorology group, and involved in the writing of the WMO report on polar meteorology in the 1960s.
No doubt you're a member of the Met Society.
Yes, I was on the Council
have
of Met Society. Two spells. I don't think I have been prominent in the Meteorological Society, really. I'm afraid I'm probably not a very good committee person. Although I do administration when I have to, and particularly when it's necessary to set up, I'd rather be doing the science or even the history. I enjoy writing. Perhaps I've been rather selfish in that regard.
Has the word reached you yet that you've been made an honorary member of the Royal Meteorological Society?
No, delighted. Oh, that's great. Thank you.
You should be getting a letter any time.
Oh, that's great.
Approved at the last council.
Oh, that's great. Thank you for telling me that. Delighted. No, I served two short spells on council. I don't know.
Did it have anything to do with the library? I know you were very concerned when
I resigned from the library committee. That's the most I had to do with it. I very strongly disapproved of the rundown of the library.
Yes.
I recognised the extent to which that was almost inevitable, that it became a bit of an odd thing to have two main meteorological libraries, that in the Met Office and the one in the Society, within a few hundred yards of each other, it would have been, in Bracknell. I believe in decentralisation a bit. In fact, I've always been sad at the demise of the old Scottish Meteorological Society.
Yes.
And I think that to have a good meteorological library in Edinburgh would be a great thing.
Mind you, I think the Met Society have perhaps compromised fairly well now in that their library is in fairly good order, sort of pre-1870.
Which good.
Is more or less when the Met Office library starts.
Yes.
And as you just said, it's pointless trying to have two libraries on each side of the roundabout.
Yes, yes.
Having all the latest data.
Yes, that'd be just a drag.
Have you ever been an editor of a scientific journal, I suppose?
I've been on editorial boards. I am on the editorial board of one or two things. I've been on the...
What are you on the editorial board on?
Quaternary Research? No, I've ceased to be on the editorial board of Quaternary Research. I'm still listed on the Quaternary... on the editorial board of that thing called Paleogeography, Paleoclimatology, Paleoecology. Yes. No, I haven't done a great deal of that sort of thing either, it's quite true to say, and I shy off refereeing papers nowadays. I find it very hard to fit in the time on that.
Yes.
I have done a fair amount of that in my time.
Well, you obviously have an enormously interesting and busy life. I feel you've enjoyed most of it, Hubert.
Very happy, yes.
I think, perhaps you had a few strokes of luck, but...
we all need that, and I certainly have.
You really have made your own career and made a great success of it.
I think it's been an extraordinarily lucky thing to the way in which the turn in my career, halfway through to working on the really long-term things of climate, which involved pulling in every kind of evidence from every field of learning.
Yeah.
I mean, it embraces what the classicists and the Egyptologists and so on may have to tell us, as well as nuclear science and the dating techniques and so on. But wedding together my interests in human history and the environment and the natural fauna and flora, as well as meteorology, that I was always interested in, to bring them all together as an actual part of my function in life, has been a tremendously rewarding, happy thing. But to some extent, of course, this is one of the things about academic life, that to retire from the university post is a very happy thing anyway. I think you still have...
That's when you've still got an office there.
That's right. That's right.
Have you ever managed to fit in any hobbies in your busy career?
Well, all these different aspects of my of my interests are in a way my hobbies. I don't know. I think most of the hobbies had to die. I used to be very keen on photography when I started.
You're
but
still a good skier and skater, I expect.
Well, very interested, very keen. I do some whenever it's possible, but I wouldn't say I was good.
One feels that your hobbies have been your work to some extent.
Yes.
You, and you've done what you wanted to do.
Well, that is true, and I've been terribly lucky to get away with it.
Well, thank you very much, Hubert. I think you have had a marvellous life, and meteorology has been the benefactor.
Well, I hope it's opened the way to some other people to follow on the same paths. They're very rewarding paths.
Well, you must be very pleased to see the way the CRU has more or less got itself established.
Yes.
Now, not only as in the university, but I mean, it's known all over the world now, and everybody knows it was Hubert Lamb who started it.
Well, I'm certainly delighted over that.
And
yes.
I don't think it's got any financial worries particularly now, anyway.
No, it's certainly very much better in that respect. I'm a bit sceptical about some of the theories of climatic change that are sweeping the board today, but
I think the carbon dioxide thesis may be overrated and things like that, so on. And in general, I tend to feel that man overrates his own importance in the scheme of things, and that nature is capable of producing quite a few shocks.
Yes, perhaps we might you might say a little on what you think of the numerical modelling of climate. Do you think this is going to provide us with any answers?
I don't know about firm answers. It's a tremendously important technique, and of course it was...
It's a test bed, I think.
It's a great test bed, and it was obvious from the beginning, or before the beginning of the real effort in numerical modelling of climate, that there had to be the two approaches to climatic history and climatic change, the theoretical one and the observational one. I felt very strongly when I started in the field that we couldn't get anywhere with understanding the development of climate unless we had an observational record, a long record of what climate actually did. That's right. It wasn't right to go too far with theory before you had actually observed what happened in the laboratory. It was quite obvious that my bent was towards helping to produce the observational record, but I never undervalued what the theoretical concepts had to produce too. And one of the strange phases that I think we had to go through, and it was an awkward one, time, 1970s, early 70s particularly, was really the theoreticians had gone a good way and were not much in the habit of talking to the observational scientists and vice versa.
Yes. Well, I think the Met Office has gone some way to remedying
that. Oh, that's well on the way to remedy now.
Yeah. I mean, our old branch in the Met Office has now got a sort of numerical section there and a statistical section
By
side.
Good, yes.
Well, I think really we have just about finished.
Yes, good. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.